Thank you very much for that contribution. I think what's interesting is that although we heard earlier on about a number of issues that were common or that could be inferred to be common, here I think we've learned about the Shanghai economy that it is in a significantly different phase of development for those in New York and London. Here, manufacturing developing very rapidly, and of course in New York and London, little manufacturing left in those economies, and indeed these two phenomena are in some ways linked. Anyway, we're now going to hear from Frank Duffy, who is principal of DEGW in London. He's going to talk to us about architectural typologies of Shanghai's new economy. Frank.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's an enormous pleasure to be here in this absolutely fascinating city in this fascinating series of conferences. I'm very proud to belong to it. I'm going to do something I've never done before. Very dangerous thing to do at this moment in one's life. But I'm going to present myself as a piece of data, as a piece of autobiographical data in relation to the subject we're talking about, which is the structure of a great city and its politics and its sociology. I'm going to try to talk about the office and my experience of how the office has developed over the last 40 years as a kind of metaphor for the city. So that's my program. I was very touched by a kind of piety when Dejan Sucic mentioned Cedric Price, a name that probably doesn't mean a great deal to those of you who are not architects, a very important person who taught me when I was a student at the Architectural Association School of Architecture in the early 60s, and probably asked the question which led to the whole structure of my life and inquiry, which is, the fundamental question was, how can you justify, given the short-termness and transience of life within buildings and in cities, how can one justify long-term architectural decisions which can, of course, last for centuries? What is the link between these two impossibly disconnected phenomena? So let me tell you what I do first and why I think I can at least offer some philosophical structure for answering that question, if I may not come to a final conclusion in the next 10 minutes. I work totally on office design. I'm an extremely specialized architect, and even within my field, I'm extremely specialized because I am what the Americans call a workplace strategist. I help clients like big clients generally, HSBC, Microsoft, Google, Accenture, plan the use of space in many locations over large geographies. That's the thing I do. And sometimes I help governments as well, the Treasury in the UK, the General Services Administration in the US. So that background explains what I'm going to say. The great thing about the office building and something that can be a metaphor for cities is that, unlike other building types, there's an extremely close geographical relation between the population and the physical fabric. Large numbers of people in complex organizations related rather precisely to the shape of buildings, and you'll see as I develop the argument about how these organizations, which are global, spread their physicality around the world. So there's a direct and fascinating relationship between the physical and the social. And what I can say about it fundamentally at the beginning, and this is the autobiographical part, there has been such fantastic change in my 40-year professional career in, for example, the simplest, the size of the office population in all economies, growth. In another obvious thing to say, in technology, the absolutely amazing change that's taken place in the last 10 years with ubiquitous, powerful, reliable information technology, which has, from my point of view, I'm not a historian, but probably the most important thing that's happened since the Industrial Revolution, in that the two conditions that shaped cities and shaped office buildings, which were co-location and synchrony, no longer persist. You do not have to be in the office at the same time with other people in order to get work done. You don't have to be there at all, in fact. So that is a fundamental change, which I'm sure will have a huge impact upon Shanghai. So let me start by this illustration here. And down at the bottom, a building that I'm enormously fond of, I think it's one of the greatest buildings of its time, which is the administrative center, the administrative offices of the Larkin Corporation in Buffalo, New York, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in 1904. One of the most important offices in the history of office architecture, a wonderful piece of work. The point about this postcard, which shows the 50 acres of the Larkin plant, is that the office function was at that time tiny. So usually when people talk about the history of office architecture, it's done in terms of magnificent architectural achievements and amazing technological developments. But because I believe they're so closely related, I'm going to try to give you a very simplified picture of types of office that have developed, and not just talk about them as physical things, but about the social process by which they're procured and managed. Next. So, yes, wouldn't it have been interesting had we had this conversation 100 years ago or 120 years ago in Chicago, at the time when that city was exploding? Who could have predicted such genius, such talent, such fantastic architectural consequences from a social, economic, population, manufacturing change? Wonderful buildings as a result of that, and that city's market is internally imbued with that period of intense creativity. Next. But I want to view the office, of course, as an architectural entity. But I think it's important to ask ourselves what office buildings are for. They're not, and this is an extremely important point to make in this room at this time, they should not be thought of as commodities to be traded. They are instruments for the development of ideas, for opening up possibilities, for generating wealth, and for supporting businesses. The three types I'm going to contrast, and I'll try to tell you a little bit. The first I've called the Taylorist office, and Larkin is a good example of that because it was actually specifically influenced by Frederick Taylor's thinking about scientific management and the removal of the person element from labor, turning it into something that was scientific and non-politicized, and just units, people were units of production in that system. The contrast with between that and the social democratic offices that started appearing in the 60s in post-Second World War Europe is amazing. Totally different set of premises underlay, as I'll try to explain, the kinds of office buildings that were built in Scandinavia and in Germany and in the Netherlands from the 60s onwards. And the third type is the least physicalized, but probably the most important for everyone in this room, which is what I call the networked office, where the reality of powerful, ubiquitous, reliable information technology is taken for granted in the disposition of people in space and time, which is the reality that we're approaching soon. So there's Larkin again. And you see, if you want to analyze its symbolism, the very clear distinction between gender, the white-bloused women, the black-coated men. Next. The extremely powerful propaganda that this great architect used for his employer, the Larkin brothers, to demonstrate to everyone who worked in this system intelligence, enthusiasm, and control. So you could be intelligent and you could be enthusiastic, provided you are controlled, and were you controlled within that system. Next. So when you look at the great buildings of the perhaps the greatest relative point, certainly, in the American economy, put up in the 50s and 60s, when that fantastic civilization was and economy was at its greatest. The Lever House next, or the magnificent Seagram building. To me, using this form of analysis, these buildings are impregnated with Taylorist ideas about control, subdivision, hierarchy, a very specific form of organizational culture. Now, I went there into the States in the early 60s, and I was absolutely amazed by the sophistication of the architecture, but also by something else, by the way in which the division of labor within the production of offices had been organized in that extremely successful economy, with a sharp separation between those architects who designed the shell of the building, which would last for 50 years or longer, and a totally different class of designer, interior designers and space planners who did the interiors, who did not talk to one another. A very characteristic of the system of separation and control. The decline of the American office, relative decline of the American office, I believe from that time, has been the result of both sides, architects with developers, architects subservient to developers more and more, and in terms of interior design, the design invention being suffocated by the professionalization of the delivery process by facilities management and corporate real estate. Next. The social democratic model, this is a turning point, this building, very important historically, Herman Hertzberger's great office in Apeldoorn in Holland, which was the last of the European post-war open plans, in which the architect attempted to create space which could be inhabited by people who were allowed to do what they want, symbolically bringing in their own furniture, their own posters, in such a way that they could demonstrate their freedom within an architectural system which was long-term. Very beautifully, never replicated. What happened next was the development of buildings like this. You see, they're totally different. They're not skyscrapers. They're low buildings. This is SAS in Stockholm. Point about this building is that it is intensely social democratic. Everyone has the same size room, with a window you can open, a wall you can bang on, and a door you can shut. You have total control over your own life. And the community is expressed in this wonderful street with the trees and the planting and the amenities which represent the organization. And even, if you want symbolism, that is the boardroom, symbolically transparent, hoisted in this public street as an example of the openness of this form of organization and this form of architecture. Now, of course, this is a direct reaction to what happened in the Second World War, and there's a lot of historical reasons for that, but very, very different to the North American model. Social democratic in every aspect of its architecture. Next. So, today, the conditions that were sketched by the previous speaker, the intense international competition and intense national competition, with innovation and agility becoming the keys to organizational success. Next. So that's where new forms of organization come in, like Accenture, which is a consultancy, but it's only one of many, which do not regard the housing issue of office workers as finding a building. Their concept is a network of people who are globalized, who are working in other clients, GSK, and Big Pharma, working on projects all through the day with highly intelligent, very well-educated scientists who are working in virtual teams in three geographies simultaneously. So the idea that a firm of consultants would have a large metro center and then have some client sites being superseded by a much richer and more diverse geography of occupation by complex changing organizations. Next. So, of course, the difference between virtuality and physical is very important. Anything I want to make here, there are certain features that I've tried to sketch here, but my own conclusion from thinking about these global organizations and the way they disperse themselves through space is that the more virtual they become, the more important place becomes, because it's full of all sorts of values, memories, associations, and above all, serendipity, things happening that are not programmed. And you can guard a city and measure the performance and potential of a city in terms of how many networks are overlapped in the city. The richness of those networks make up a modern city. But they're not necessarily, these organizations, enclosed in the Shell Centre or the Seagram Building. They have a much more mobile and a much richer geography. Next. And they look like this. Next. Now, the procurement is the final thing I want to say. The Taylorist office was developer-led, highly standardized, leased in a vast legal apparatus that was developed in order to make that possible, and exchange-driven fundamentally, made worse, as I tried to describe earlier, by the shift in power within these organizations from the people who work to the, not even the owners now, they're owned by the delivery system, not even by the corporate organizations. The Social Democratic Office, which is purpose-built, highly specific, long-term ownership, use-driven, produces wonderful environments, but has another basic defect, which is rigidity, in that the social democratic ideals have found their way into the German and Dutch and Scandinavian building regulations, so you cannot build an office which does not have these characteristics, and it cannot change. The third model, networked, just emerging, as much about services as space, although space is important, responsive to customer demand, therefore there's a fee inherent in it, paid for by the hour, not by the square meters, by the year or the month, and its use to the organization is the value it adds to intellectual organizations which have to survive by generating and sustaining ideas. So understanding that supply chain is important, and it's silly to talk about the shape of a building without understanding how rooted it is in culture and how rooted it is in the way in which these buildings are designed and delivered. Next. So yes, the office, I believe, does provide a metaphor for the city. The way in which designers, talking about short-term issues with end users and strategic issues with clients who are in multiple places, can offer a model of dealing with different timescales at the same time in a coherent and nested way. Next. So from the point of view of Shanghai, which I'm so pleased to be in, it's not which type you should choose. I'm not saying you should take the social democratic model or reject the North American model, the Taylorist model. It's the strategic question is how much of each do you need now, and how is that balance going to change in the next 20 years, which I believe can be modeled and thought through and will provide a rational basis for at least part of the city designing program. Thank you.